Dr. Damian Milton is a sociologist and lecturer at the University of Kent on intellectual and developmental disabilities through the Tizard Center. He's also a consultant for the National Autistic Society in the UK, a project leader for the National Autism Task Force, and is involved in many other research and practice-related projects. His most recent book is A Mismatch of Salience: Explorations in Autism Theory and Practice. His theory of the double empathy problem is bringing a paradigm shift to understandings of autism in the field. Dr. Damian Milton, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk first about the double empathy problem. For background, the diagnostic criteria of autism has traditionally characterized autistic people as having an impaired understanding of social life, this sort of standard way people talk about, quote, missing social cues and things like that. And this historically has been portrayed as a deficit unique to autistic people. But in the double empathy problem, which you coined and describe in your work, we shift away from this old deficit model to something else. Can you describe this shift or what the double empathy problem is?
Yeah, it's the double empathy problem, where that phrase came from, was originally trying to advise a parent group that I was involved with many years ago. And I was trying to explain that this kind of so-called empathy difficulties or theory of mind difficulties were a two-way process. If you like, theory of autistic mind often left a lot to be desired, as it were. Mm-hmm. And so my background academically has been more in the areas of sociology and social psychology, at least initially. And so when I was diagnosed myself and I was coming across this research around theory of mind, it just struck me as missing the obvious, it would seem, that social interaction involves more than one person. Mm-hmm. And so empathy difficulties, to me, logically would be problematic for both parties. And so there is more nuance and different contexts and issues that fed into that, but as a base idea, that was what it was driving at. And it was a shift away from the deficit in social interaction or the problem purely being located in the mind of the autistic person. And so that, however, creates a bit of instability over what exactly autism is in the first place, mm-hmm. because of how it's diagnosed and how it's usually framed. So more recently, there has been quite a lot of different experimental studies and pieces of research which have been testing various aspects of this out. There's the work of Noah Sasson, Brett Heisman, Elizabeth Shepherd and Danny Roper. There's a number of researchers now looking at this area. Some work in Scotland with Sue Fletcher-Watson and Catherine Crompton. So lots of researchers now looking at this area and finding that, lo and behold, there are problems with non-autistic people trying to empathize with autistic people in various ways. So there's more work to be done, though, I think, in the nuances on how this all plays out.
Yeah, they don't really... I mean, the idea is that a non-autistic person is not really getting what an autistic person is experiencing or expressing either, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's qualitative evidence I've had in research where young autistic children say these things. So, a quote from one child in some years ago was, 95% of people don't understand me. As one example, and quotes like this. And very frequently in young children in school who were verbal and able to express that. And often there's more comments like that in qualitative research than struggles to empathize with others, although there's also comments there. So to me, the picture is the theory of mind is partial at best. So,
right. I think it's a generally agreed upon that neurotypicals don't get it, and that's a life, a common experience that people have. And
exactly.
It's funny that
when you talk about this with autistic people, they know exactly what you're talking about.
Right. But then if you look at how, I think a lot of how the autism, even the intervention theory, because you've said empathy is conceptual and situational, and that's very true. And obviously all the research is pointing that out as well. And that's a key point. But so much of the autism intervention theory to date mostly has been about kind of what can be measured or judged from outside about a person. So the OT has their little chart and they tick off the chart and the measures of success and the benchmarks, they're all colored by a lot of presuppositions in the field based around this idea of theory of mind. And this maybe is why a lot of neurotypical experts have missed the mark. There seems to be a perception problem with how they understand autistic experiences, and maybe more importantly, how they understand the needs of the people that they're trying to serve. That what they're measuring and their measures of success aren't necessarily what the actual people, for example, a child, might need, might really need.
Yeah. I would agree with what you're saying there. And if you think how one conceptualizes autism leads to how one then acts or upon that information, so what to do about it, so how to intervene, what to intervene with, all follows from how you frame autism in the first place. Then how you measure it or what you're measuring depends on those goals. So a lot of the outcome measures that are being used in research or practice do not equate well with the goals that the autistic people might have themselves, especially when you take into account this double empathy issues. And so there's problematic ethical issues about the goals of what interventions are for, whatever model one's using. What is this intervention? What's the goal of it? What is it being used to try and promote, in a sense, or not, as the case may be?
Right. It's not just it's not always just a goal. I mean, a lot of times it's a bit of an agenda or it's somebody else's goal. The goal, for example, of making a child appear quote, indistinguishable from peers. They use those kind of phrases, and that's kind of at the apex of their flowcharts and intervention plans. But that goal is really shallow when you look at the real needs, the sensory needs and the emotional needs and all the other needs of the people that they're serving. I'm thinking particularly in a school setting. They want to have, you know, like, for example, with me, the OT had me cutting out paper lanterns, like, every day after school, because if I knew how to cut out a paper lantern, I would look like everyone else. And her, I do believe she sincerely felt that that was what I wanted most of all, was just to be, to look like everyone else. And there were really so many more things that I needed and wanted.
To fit in and,
you know, that wasn't the top of the list. And yeah, it's quite something. And so it gets into sort of a bigger issue of, well, what is fulfillment and how conceptual or situational or relative is this idea, or subjective, is the idea of fulfillment? Because I don't think that they can really create good systems unless they really check in and have significant consultation with autistic people about what fulfillment might really look like. Because I don't think they're...
Yes, quite. This is a big topic for me, I think, in terms of what is quality of life and fulfillment? What does that look like? And some things are perhaps somewhat commonalities between people, health and safety and security and life, but a right to an education perhaps. But then beyond some of these base ideas, how someone leads a fulfilling life is highly subjective. And in some of the work I've done, I use theories which, there's one I've used called personal construct theory, which is all about how people construct and conceptualize the world themselves. So it's using their language and their sense of the world, trying to get into that space with them, with their permission, of course. Rather than imposing, which comes into the some of the things you were talking about, like the paper lantern stuff, there's a misperception of the motivations of the child and why they're reacting or not to an activity or engaging in one or not, built on ideas which, from a non-autistic perspective, and social conformity, following the norm, fitting in, consensus, all of these things are often highly valued in the non-autistic culture, sometimes for good reason. Sometimes that goes way too far, especially for people with disabilities or invisible disabilities and differences. And the old goal of, as you said, of indistinguishable from their peers, I'm sure some who might listen to this podcast would say, oh, we're that's not what we do anymore, and we don't do that. But it's more subtle, in a sense, rather than a clearly stated goal, as it once was and still is for some, like Ivor Lovaas and his followers. But there was a more subtle normalization, and this comes from access to normal life and validation from that, and somehow a fulfilling life will come from fitting in and behaving like other people and so on. And this can become quite oppressive for people who either don't know how or do not wish to, for whatever reason. Sometimes this sanctioning of abnormal behavior, if you like, is quite ridiculous as to what people are getting concerned about.
Right.
And then you're imposing on autistic sensibilities without taking those needs into account quite often. And so any kind of intervention, educationally or psychological therapies, what have you, whatever the goal is, without taking those autistic sensibilities into account, you're quite possibly going to harm people or do damage. And I think that's a problem for practitioners working with autistic people everywhere, is trying not to harm people should be number one priority, ethically. And so, and working to enable and empower that trust and rapport in that relationship, rather than imposing and sanctioning and so on. But all too often in practice, that's what we see, restraint, seclusion, and so on at the extreme end. But that, unfortunately, happens far too often.
Right. I think in terms of accountability and ethics, it's pretty new for these issues to even be talked about. And I think a lot of that has come out of the disability rights movement and the autistic self-advocacy movement calling for accountability. And but there's a long way to go because it's a really entrenched system. And I was wondering what you think, because you're a parent, I'm also a parent, and we both are parents of autistic kids as well. So we have to relate within the existing system of services and watch for change that happens very, very, very slowly, at least here in Ontario. I'm wondering what your perspective is on where we're at and where we could be going in terms of these early services to make them better.
Where we're at, I think, is still not a great place from my point of view. I think there's a lot of this ideology of a window of opportunity of child development. And if you get in the early years, you'll be able to modify that for the better somehow in a very normative way. And I think it's very problematic. And I think, yes, you can get ideally supports in and understanding for that potential developments, but then there's so much diversity on the spectrum, it's hard to know in those early years how someone's going to develop. And that's another thing, is with interventions, a lot of the time people will claim that a change is because of what they've been doing to support that child or what have you, when really it's the child just maturing and developing, growing older. And they may have got to that point anyway.
Or despite the intervention.
Or despite it. And there's often an assumption that one has more control over a situation than one really has. Or the opposite, one has... doesn't know one is having an effect when one is. So it's there's a lot of issues when it comes to intervention and interpretation of what's making the change. And there's often a confirmation bias there that if you're putting in all this effort, that it must be doing some good.
Right.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the whole idea of what is the evidence, really? How can you
exactly,
really...
So the way to change this is to, on a number of levels, we need more participation of autistic people into support strategies and what they're for and how people are treated, in a meaningful way, not a tokenistic one. We need much better standards of research and intervention. There's Michelle Dawson, who's maybe known to your audience, talks about this a great deal, and with good reason. So the evidence base is not strong for many of these things. And then you have, what is the evidence of? What are the outcome measures measuring?
That's right.
So what are the goals and so on? So there also needs an implementation in practice. Practice can be messy. You might make mistakes. You need to be reflective practitioners and humble in your practice. So I think the very best practitioners are humble when they meet a new person and want to get to know that person and what motivates them, what sensitivities they have and so on. A poor practitioner would be someone who thinks they know it all and can just apply a model and an intervention, and that's what you do with autistic people. Tick box. So,
well, that's been in ABA. That's pretty common. I mean, the outcome measures in ABA, they aren't measuring things like happiness and fulfillment.
No, not often, and if there's an overconfidence in the intervention and the method, this is problematic, or their application of it. And I would say this is a problem in a lot of ABA practice that I've come across. Perhaps not all, but is a common issue. For me, I have deeper issues on the theory and philosophy of behaviorism about human minds and learning. I think it's oversimplified and often over reductionist, as it were. And it can lead to an over reliance on that theory, leads to people not looking at potential cognitive theory or subjective ideas around qualitative studies around quality of life, what it means to be autistic, what it means to have an autistic good life for that person, is often ignored, along with cognitive theories are often ignored as well. So whether they're the old ones like executive functioning or newer ones like predictive coding or what have you that are being applied. Often with behaviorist practice, it's just the behavior and behaviorist theory that's being used and nothing but. Do you see what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sometimes only certain aspects of behaviorist theory, the most problematic aspects.
Yeah, or a simplified version of behaviorist theory when it comes to implementation in practice, which, if married up with this normalization or an imposing approach from a practitioner, which often if they're not well experienced or underconfident themselves, they might actually do more of. It's a kind of heady cocktail, I would say, for potential harms there when it goes wrong. And often that isn't, I think, acknowledged enough by those who are practicing it or the researchers in that field. So it's often sold as behavioral support is good for you and it's evidence-based and blah, blah, and it's overselling the case by quite a lot and not mentioning the potential downsides or when it goes badly wrong, which it can do like any serial practice with people.
Right, and they're not...
One needs to be critical, self-critical, whatever theory and practice one's using.
And I don't think there's really comparing it against anything. I mean, that isn't that part of it as well? Like, I mean, there's no other group of people that they, in the studies that I see that are coming out, besides bias issues and all the issues that you just mentioned, there really isn't a, you can't compare, again, everybody's an individual, every person's an individual, and they also don't have like a another group of people that aren't doing it that they're really actively comparing it against. Because when I look at the window theory and this idea of early intervention, 30 hours a week, all day in the ABA center, I've never seen a study that compares the kids that are 30 hours a week in the ABA center versus the kids that got to play. Where's that study? You know?
Well, there's often in these studies what's called a control group, and there's said practice as usual and things, but these are hardly ever explained what that means, or where this practice is happening or who's conducting it. Sometimes you get a bit more information on that. But often it's not compared to an alternative practice model. And I'd love to see an autistic-informed practice model being fully tested in this way. And but if you were to compare models, then you'd have to agree upon outcome measures that were meaningful, which is not happening either. So I would say a lot of the issues go beyond the evidence to ideological divides and controversies. And this is, goes back to how autism itself is being framed and defined as a deficit, as something in need of remediation, a medical model problem, or a way of being which can be highly disabling in the societies we're in, and what can we do to help support and accommodate these needs, which a more social model approach, as it were. And I think the combination of that mindset and framing with a more person-centered, autistic-informed practice would ultimately lead to better quality of life and fulfillment on people's own terms.
Right.
And this goes beyond those who are on the autistic spectrum, who are highly verbal or articulate. My son has... would be classified as having severe learning disabilities or intellectual disability, as it were. But there are ways of working, say, with my son, which lead to him being safer and more fulfilled and interested and engaged. And that means getting to know him, what interests him. His sensory sensitivities are very strong, and so what his likes and dislikes are. And that takes time and effort in engaging with him. But do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So this kind of ethos needs to be central, because another key area, I think, is around stress and the perception of threat and fear and anxiety and so on. And so if one's not aware of that happening and trying to teach or trying to do anything in a learning environment, say, with a young child, if they're overly stressed, they're not going to be able to learn anything. And so if the school environment or the teaching method is adding to that stress, then you're not really creating an environment which is going to be educationally fulfilling and engaging for that child.
Sometimes in the classroom setting, I mean, it's really ad hoc here in Ontario. I mean, teachers will sort of try things, but in terms of a real accessible design in the classroom so that the students can feel comfortable, all students can feel comfortable, we don't have that. There's really a lot of money around autism in my province and elsewhere, and the money isn't going so very much or at all towards that kind of a goal of making learning spaces comfortable. And some of those ways to do that are quite simple, but just not being done. And you're right, when the stress level is so high, I mean, you can't, it's like just putting on Band-Aids. I wanted to ask you about your work where it's being incorporated into training programs for like the National Autistic Society, Studio 3's Atlas program at Autism Synergy program, and among others. Mm-hmm. How are these new programs different from the earlier type of programs in that way?
Well, the Synergy program by At Autism and the Atlas training by Studio 3, those two in particular are training or creating practice models which are similar to what we've just been talking about, where autistic people like myself have been involved in the development and delivery of this. And there's highly experienced practitioners, but with a different framing as to how to help autistic people, which is far more around the environment and often the behavior of the people around the autistic person. Mm-hmm. So often they may be training people who've had a behaviorist background. So one thing one can do is turn the kind of direction of who's looking at whom, and it's how does one look at the stress levels of staff in a care unit or something like that, or teachers for that matter. How's the interaction of stress between the child and the staff? And they also would look at why not use your behavioural checklist but measure the antecedents of what makes this child smile or laugh? And it kind of shocks people because they're so used to watching for the problem, mm-hmm. the crisis, the challenge, the meltdown, rather than looking at what's is fulfilling for that person. So, and also it's, they're more informed by cognitive theory, autistic input and all of that. And it makes, I think, a big difference. And all of the training you mentioned there, it's having autistic input at a meaningful level in the training. And from experienced people, so people who also work in the field who may be autistic themselves too. So a lot of autistic people are also parents or also professionals and have a lot to add, particularly if we work together on these things. Which is possible sometimes.
I want to relate this to an issue that we have in the autistic self-advocacy movement, because you're talking about autistic people being consultants, and we're certainly working towards that. But I think sometimes that we're being told by some parents, not all, by some parents, through this myth of the functioning labels, high functioning, low functioning, and this sort of binary, that we can't understand their situation because we're at different levels, or we're not severe, we're not like their child. And of course, the self-advocacy movement does represent and have the full range of needs, disabilities, and communication needs within our community. But beyond that, it's a superficial, I think, understanding of autism, because regardless of the individual life experiences, there are things there is a way that we're all connected, or we empathize and identify with one another, like Silberman calls it a neurotribe. So I'm wondering, like, what your thoughts are about that connection, and also why there's resistance to accepting the connection among us in the consultation process.
Yes, it's, there's a lot of issues there, I think. The "you're not like my child," and it's kind of thing, it's, well, they're not like my son either, even less so. And one of the problems is thinking there's no connection or no cultural connection. So often it's a disagreement around how autism is being framed, so the medical social model type division, but being aimed because you have a different point of view, so therefore you do not speak for my situation, and your situation might be very similar in certain ways. And there's often assumptions that when a lot of people say in the neurodiversity movement are parents of autistic children with high support needs, and that is assumed we're not, when it's which is a bit strange to me because I've met quite a few, and or that we wouldn't be working as practitioners or professionals or with wider groups of wider range of needs. And so many autistic people I know have an affinity with autistic people across the spectrum, as it were, and work as practitioners, work with children, work as researchers, what have you, working to improve the lives of autistic people with higher support needs, because they can see the distress that people are often under and relate. So me and my son on the, say, on the outside would appear very different on first impressions to an onlooker. But that doesn't tell you much about how we would empathize and with one another. This goes back to the whole double empathy thing. And because autistic people can empathize and relate with others who may have similar dispositions, similar experiences, similar interests, and so on. So in a way, the lack of empathy thing is a myth. And yet, say on sensory sensitivities, both me and my son have very high sensory sensitivities to external things, so light, smells, sounds, and so on. So often I'll be very quick at understanding what's upsetting him in a given context, whilst other people wouldn't be. Yes, that's partly comes from being his parent, but it also comes from having those same sensitivities myself. So without those, that ability to empathize with him, I'd easily miss that.
Right.
So the idea that more verbal autistic people don't have anything of value to share, which may be of use to those with more less verbal abilities or whatever, is wrong. And yes, you do have autistic people who may not have come across in person people like my son. They may be younger people, activists or what have you. they may not understand the situation this particular parent is in. But often it's used to undermine the position the autistic person is advocating for. Do you see what
right.
I mean? So yeah. If they were agreeing with them, they wouldn't be saying, you don't speak for
right.
me. They'll be saying, oh, I empathize. I can understand where you're coming from.
Right, right.
So the problem is ideological.
I think you're right. It's at the core of it. I'm going to shift, since we're talking about play and how we play and how delightful it is to play, I'm going to talk a little bit about your discussion of flow states, because this seems to relate to play. You write about how what neurotypicals would call repetitive behaviors can be interpreted very differently, are interpreted very differently, through the idea of the flow state. Could you say more about the flow state?
Yeah, the idea of flow states came from a psychologist who I can't pronounce very well, so I won't try. But the idea of a flow state, though, is when you're completely absorbed in an activity. So if you think of an activity you particularly enjoy or are particularly engaged with, you can become so absorbed that you lose track of oneself, lose track of time. You become, in a sense, in the activity. Sports people might call it being in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
So you're so focused and all your attention is matching up well. Sometimes this can be achieved through a challenge, as long as the challenge isn't too much or too difficult. So meeting a challenge, as it were, learning something new. Sometimes it can be those two stress reducing. So being in the flow state can be something brought about, I think, for autistic people particularly through predictability and having control over an activity. In a sense, playing,
mm-hmm.
but in a controllable way. I think the autistic perception is often one which is fragmented, somewhat overloading, difficult at times to make sense of the world around one when there's too much going on to process. So honing in on what is predictable and controllable reduces stress. So some of the repetitive behaviors, and stimming, say, is a stress-reducing activity. But also the passionate interests that autistic people have in particular things can be ways of getting into a flow state. Something I do when training practitioners about autism is I ask them what it's like when they've ever tried to interrupt an autistic person when they're fully engaged in an activity. And usually they cotton on quite quickly as to what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Because say that flow is interrupted, for an autistic person, you can go from a place of safety and everything is how it should be to the complete opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that kind of makes sense to people, that can be a highly stressful thing to do to someone.
Right.
And so there are ways, if you explain things like that, that people can start empathizing a bit better than perhaps they might have done before if taking things like that on board as well. So what people do to achieve a flow state may differ from one person to the next, though. So it's quite related to interest and attention and areas like that.
I think that understanding flow state, or being able to get into a flow state, or even better, being able to connect in a flow state together, which I certainly do with my son around various things, especially when we're out at the beach or other places like that. Maybe that's something that, as we learn more, think more about flow state, joining in flow state with a child could almost be taught, or the whole idea could be taught to people so that they have an empathy of it and also an ability to experience it on some level, even together.
I think there are some interventions with, there's what's called intensive interaction, which I would have some issues with, but is heading more in that direction. It's more about relationship building and rapport building and getting inside the child's world and understanding where they're coming from and working with that and so on. And I think there are practices which are heading in that direction as an idea. In terms of mutual flow or a kind of social flow between people, this is very important, I think, because the double empathy problem is a breakdown in mutual flow. It's a breach, if you like, mutual incomprehension, which can get very bad in some situations for both parties. But if you think of mutual flow, for a lot of non-autistic people, they'll find that in small talk with one another. They'll lose track of time just talking nonsense about the weather. Yeah. Maybe that's the British thing, I don't know. But, and then, so you can have mutual flow in social interaction. But there are other ways of finding a social flow with people. If you think of music and a jam session, the musicians may be communicating through the music they're playing and bodily gestures and nods and so on, and very few words being spoken at all. Yet it's a mutual social flow. One that would probably suit some autistic people much better than a group social interaction using words. So if you think creatively about how to engage with this person's interests, what drives them, then finding a mutual flow is probably a lot more likely. And that's with both verbal and non-verbal or less verbal autistic people.
Well, I hope there's more. I hope you do more work on the flow state and all of the work that you're doing. You're part of a wave of scholars that are moving us away from this older idea of centering the norm, where differences were always being seen as deficits, and more of a positive understanding of difference and also of reciprocity, which seems really, really key.
I would have to agree with you there. I think we have still a long way to go. But looking at reciprocity and the context, the environment, and what's meaningful for that person and how that they communicate that and so on, it's being a lot more respectful of autistic ways of being and working with that rather than trying to take away the autism somehow as if it's something separate to that person. A lot of the old models try to do.
Right. What would a new model look like? What are they starting to look like from what you're seeing?
Person-centered, humble, focus on learning from autistic experience, building local capacity with practitioners. So instead of busing in the so-called expert at vast expense to do an hour of work or training is to build up the understanding, confidence, and knowledge in a workplace. And that needs a bit of a culture shift,
really.
And from across an organization. And I can see this happening in certain schools or care places where the leadership all the way through the culture of that place is a good one and they're really helping people as best they can. And I see others where the culture is horrendous, really, and the structures. And often it's the leadership of leading an institution or organization which are somewhat at fault, I would say, not seeing the real issues for what they are. And sometimes I think there's the perception of risk and management of risk often motivates people. But the more you try and manage a person as if they're just a risk to be managed, the less trust they're going to have in you, and the more you're going to break down that trust, which actually adds to actual risk.
That's right.
And so if people focused more on trust and relationship building, would be beneficial. Unfortunately, the very things that do that are sometimes the things which are least well-funded or the threat of being cut as services. As an example, in the UK of one-stop shop, which are kind of community centres where you can meet others, get information, and so on. Where and this is kind of community support and intervention is highly valued by people in that community.
Yes.
So people may not hit a crisis point and need very expensive mental health support, yet the crisis support is what's being funded, however badly it's being done, and that more social preventative stuff isn't being. Do you see what I mean?
Right, so, we have the same thing here. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's that kind of culture shift and focus of where the investment is going and how and why, which really needs looking at, which is on a policy, a political level. And the valuing of social supports and services.
Yeah, it's something where, personally here in Ontario, we just are starting to get our foot in the door. I mean, we're, as an organization, my organization is 15 months old, and we're competing against, for example, ABA. They have a lobbying firm. They have a big lobbying firm with a lot of money, and they have a package which is easy to understand for people that don't understand anything. It appears easy to understand, and they're able to sell to policymakers. But, I mean, we don't have a lobby. And one thing that I think everyone in the disability communities are starting to coalesce, at least as an interest group, to put these interests forward, because we're a bit too siloed now with the various community programs to compete with the level, the volume of that lobby.
It's an industry.
Mm-hmm.
Really. So, and where there's money to be made and vested interests, a challenge to that will be seen as a threat to them. That's why they often do not like being criticized for what they're doing. And so it's a very difficult thing to do, but yes, we do need to organise and work with others. So it's not just autistic people or disabled people. There are practitioners and parents and so on who would agree with our way of thinking, perhaps, on these issues. And it's creating a bit of lobbying pressure at a political level, but using evidence and rationale. So that does mean, I think, at times critiquing the work of others, like the ABA lobby and so on, and trying to show what the issues might be with that in a respectful, credible way.
Mm-hmm.
Not just saying, oh, it's all bad, it's all abuse or whatever. It's, these are the issues and the criticisms that have not been answered. And one of the things that does annoy me somewhat is that often I see articles by behaviourists answering criticisms that aren't really being made.
Yeah, I see that. I know.
Or misframing criticisms, mm-hmm. and oversimplifying them, and not actually answering or attempting to the very real issues that there are. And it's that kind of thing which is difficult to deal with. But I think the way forward is to show policymakers the actual evidence base, which is pretty poor, make an argument of around the goals of intervention and what support strategies should be trying to do, so around outcome measures and so on, making the case for participation ethically.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully the quality should improve over time. And we also need better standards of research and to support policies. And so one thing we're seeing time and again is a widespread usage of things which are not well supported. But it came to be, and often don't have the support of the very people that you're intervening with.
Yes, that is very, very common. In your work that's upcoming, can you talk a little bit about what you're working on currently?
I'm currently chair of a group called a network really called the Participatory Autism Research Collective, or PARC for short. And it's really a network promoting the participation of autistic people in the research itself, so the design of and carrying out of research, whether that's becoming researchers like myself and or people just interested in research and having a voice within it who may not be academics themselves. So it's promoting participation at a meaningful level. I'm also a project leader for a group called the National Autistic Task Force in the UK, which is a small group of autistic people who we're quite experienced as a group in different areas, and we're trying to influence policy guidance and practice and so on at a better, more informed level than has been the case in the past, or just putting pressure on and being critical, being a group that can put in to consultations on policy documents and so on. So it's being seen to have that voice and put that across. In the future, kind of research-wise, I'm interested in more practical work around sensory issues and the sensory environment and adapting environments and what impact that can have on quality of life for, say, autistic children in schools and so on. Mm-hmm. So sensory in areas is one area.
You've been listening to Noncompliant. I'm your host, Ann Borden-King. Noncompliant was recorded at DB Audio and MCS Recording Studios. Various episodes were engineered by Dave Boire, Nathan Gravatt, and TJ Liebgott. Thanks to our engineers, and thanks for listening.
Dinah Murray and Wen Lawson and people. Matching that up with double empathy issues. And also work that's happening in more neuroscientific field around what's called predictive coding theory. And there's a growing interest in applying those theories in the field of autism.
Oh, interesting.
And I think the coming together of autistic voices and with neuroscience could be quite interesting. It's a bit of a mouthful. It's called neurophenomenology. It's a new field, but phenomenology being a more qualitative, interpretive work around subjective meanings and experience, and the neuroscience bit and working together, really. And I think bringing these theories and ideas together, working across disciplines, could create a different model of how we see autism itself, or neurodiversity for that matter. And I think better is possible, especially in the academic field around this. So, and I think where there are ways of working with others that can be beneficial, we should be doing so. I do think there are those in the field that I wouldn't be working with for various reasons. But where positive things can be done that will benefit the community, then great. I'm all for that. But I do have standards, I'd say, on that as well.
Well, sometimes it's easier to go across. I would guess it would be easier to go across the disciplines sometimes because you have people that are a little bit more of a clean slate and a different type of perspective and aren't so embedded in some of the older ideas.
Well, I think that's one of the problems in academia is working across disciplines, and but it's just because it can be difficult doesn't mean it shouldn't be being attempted, and especially when you're looking at people and applied topics, so how to support people. This is a multidisciplinary exercise. So I think better is possible, and we can make improvements, but there are also barriers to that and the vested interests and so on and other lobby groups and things. So it's not easy.
It was so interesting speaking to you about all of these ideas and also about the work that you're doing in academia and beyond academia, both really important, all really important areas to be working in. And I want to thank you so much, especially for coming on the program and everything that you do.
And thank you, and I wish you all the best for your efforts in Canada.
We were speaking with Dr. Damian Milton, a sociologist and lecturer at the University of Kent. He spoke to us from Kent.